Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 9th of July 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Normally this show would be live, but we are actually pre-recording this one. If you want to join us live, it goes out every Friday night at 8 p.m. British time. You're welcome to join us in the chat room and add some comments or add some questions. We do like to get feedback on this show. It is a new show and we hope that you are enjoying it. I am saying we, and that is because I have a co-host with me on Patriotic History, and the co-host is the Patriarch. Patriarch, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. I've been enjoying working with you. I was pretty impressed with the subjects that you came up with last week, talking about language. It really helped the show out, I think, and I learned some new things about how the words face in different directions and how they all face towards Jerusalem, the actual letters in the alphabets there. Do you want to just repeat that again? Because I thought that was a really interesting point that you made last week.
Yeah, well, if you notice that all the Western nations tend to have their language read left to right, and then all the nations in the East tend to have the text read from right to left, and you know, it inevitably seems to just point back to the center. And I think the difference was between the Phoenician and the Greek, and to say they had the first five letters of their alphabet near enough identical but mirrored, it was almost like they set out to prove a point, or you know, to start a new era almost. So to me, it kind of suggests that they were from the same era, but then as they migrated further west, they wanted to switch things up, and then they just flipped it on its axis and then developed the language from there. But I would like to get to the definite reason why that happened. But
as they travel further away from the center, things evolve and they change more as they go on in time. And yeah, what we're showing really in this series is the connections that are there between us today and the people back then. And when you want to find out about the people of the past, you go back through your history. You don't dig under the ground underneath you, because you don't know how long your people have actually been in this country. And as white people, we've traveled all over the world setting up empires, setting up civilizations. Last week we learned about the Hittites, and we learned about the word Arab, and this week we're going to be looking at the science and technology of these first white empires. But first, we're going to mention two of the other main people groups that populated Sumer and the Fertile Crescent, the Gutians and the Amorites. And the first of these, the Gutians, after the Akkadians had ruled Sumer for around 200 years, the Gutians invaded and took over. They came from the Zagros Mountains in Persia, and their rule lasted for around 100 years. These Gutians were seen as uncultured, being described in tablets from the time as barbarians, having the intelligence of dogs and the appearance of monkeys, while speaking a language similar to a confused babble. Yet the language they spoke was quite close to the language spoken by the Tocharians, who are a white tribe known to us today to be Indo-European in ethnicity, and we'll be talking about them a bit later in the series. And in the early years of the 20th century, the historians actually mistook the Gutians for being the origins of the Goths, and I think we now see that the Massagete actually were closer to the Goths than these Gutians. But what really strikes me as interesting here is that these are white people, and you've got other white people that are describing them as barbarians, having the intelligence of dogs and the appearance of monkeys, while speaking a language similar to a confused babble. And you may look at that and think, well, they can't have been white. And yet, when you think about it, they're saying they had the appearance of monkeys. That could well be because they were wearing furs. Because when we look at the Sumerians, they were wearing sort of dresses, short dresses for the men and long dresses for the males, long dresses for the females, rather. And what they're saying here is that these people had the appearance of monkeys. So I think they could well have been wearing furs, and of course they're going to run them down because they're the enemy. They're going to say that they've got the intelligence of dogs and barbarians, and I mean, outside the Roman Empire was described as being barbarians. Essentially, these people were proto-Persians. They were actually from Persia, and these Tocharians, they are particularly interesting. We'll get into them, as I say, in a later episode. Do you know anything about the Gutians? You got any comments you want to make on these Gutians, Patriarch?
It's the first time I'd heard of them, to be honest. But you say they had a similar language, right?
Yeah.
So they must have some cultural relation there. They must have evolved, if they have a similar language, I can only assume that at some point they would have been somewhat connected or influenced, intertwined.
Well, yeah, I mean, it says that they're Indo-European, and originally L.A. Waddell thought that they were the Goths, and he was looking at them, and he was referring to the Goths as being some of the earliest Aryans, but he was getting mixed up, and it was these Gutians that he was actually referring to, not the people that we know today as Goths. But they didn't rule for very long. They only ruled for about 100 years. And then following that period, there was a brief Sumerian Renaissance in the 21st century BC, cut short in the 20th century BC by invasions of the Amorites. And the Amorites were Hamites, so we know that they must have started out as being white. We've also got depictions of them that show that they were white. The Amorite dynasty of Isin persisted until circa 1700 BC, when Mesopotamia was united under Babylonian rule. And it was these Amorites who actually wrote the king lists that we referred to in earlier episodes that told us that after the flood, the kingship began in Kish. And Wikipedia tells us that the original Sumerian types were then eventually absorbed into the Akkadian population. So they became absorbed into the Assyrian Babylonian population. And these Amorites, this dynasty of Isin, were actually writing about the events of what happened after the flood, but they were writing about it 1,000 years after the actual flood. Whereas when we look at the Genesis account, that's quite clearly an eyewitness tablet, and it tells you who was the eyewitness. It was Shem, and it tells you how old he was when this tablet was written. He was 100 years old. Whereas these Amorites, when they were writing about it, they're writing about events that happened 1,000 years ago, and it's coloured by the Sumerian myths as well, and the Sumerian gods that were all sort of pre-flood gods, the Anunnaki, the ones that created the black-headed race and the servant race that we were suggesting were the Arabs. Have you got any comments on the Amorites at all, Patriarch?
The most I'd heard of them was from reading the Bible, you know, and obviously they're quite prolific, aren't they, as being the main sort of competitors and rivals to Israel and around those areas, the Amorites, Hittites. That's pretty much what I've known of them. So this is news to me.
Yeah, they fit in with the Canaanites, but they were white. But this explains why there was an issue with them in the Bible, because Wikipedia is telling us that these original Sumerian types were eventually absorbed into the Akkadian population. What this is telling us is that the Sumerians were displaced by the nations descended from Noah, and they blended with some of those peoples, particularly the descendants of Ham and Canaan, because these Amorites were descended from Ham, and the Sumerians, who were descended from Cain and were Arab types and also the black-headed peoples, they blended in with these Amorites. And that explains the biblical animosity towards those nations. And it also explains why the first evidence we have of Indo-European being spoken is mixed in with Akkadian and belongs to the Hittites, the Canaanite tribe. So we see that there's a connection between these Cainite peoples, these Nephilim-type peoples that were created by the Anunnaki, and a connection with these Canaanites and also with the Hamites. So it explains the biblical animosity towards them. It gives these reasons for it, basically, because people, you know, were saying, well, why is it that these tribes, particularly on Ham's side of the family, why is it that they were known as unclean? Why was it that they were always at war with the Israelites? Why were the Israelites told that they weren't supposed to marry the Canaanites? And it was because that these were all mixed races. They had all ended up mixing in with these Sumerians. And the Israelites were told to not to give their daughters to the sons of a strange god, and vice versa, basically. So this confirms how that happened, how this race mixing happened, is confirmed in Wikipedia when it tells us that these Sumerian types were eventually absorbed into the Akkadian population. And also you get like the Assyrians and the Babylonians, they end up being enemies in the Old Testament as well. And they were the Akkadians, and yet they all started out as originally as being part of the same family.
Yeah, it's interesting.
At the end of this 1,000-year period that we've just been discussing, it is estimated that there were around 1 million people in Sumer, and this includes all the different races, not just the whites. And the entire world population of humans at that time is guessed at being 27 million people, according to the World Atlas of Population History. And for a measure of how many people that is, England had 55 million people in 2018. So just 2 years ago, yeah, England had twice as many people as they estimate were living in the world back then, four or 5,000 years ago.
It's quite staggering, really, to think, you know, how uninhabited the earth was. I mean, you know, lineage and, you know, passing on your seed must have been so important back then. Well, probably a lot more so than it is now. You know, whoever expanded their line, essentially they knew that they would kind of have dominion over the earth. I guess it was kind of like the space race back then, wasn't it? They knew, well, I assume they knew that the earth was relatively unpopulated. They must have noticed that there's vast spaces of empty land.
Well, I think there was even more. I think there was even more than they say here, because, I mean, they say that there was a million people living in Sumer. You think that was the centre of the world. That was the centre of civilization. That was the Fertile Crescent. Just 1 million people. And from that, they extrapolate, well, there must have been 27 million people in the rest of the world. But where is there evidence of those peoples? And when we look at say Africa, we see that the African population has exploded exponentially just in the last century. Yeah. I mean, I tend to think that back then, the way that the races are now, with whites making up, I think, what is it, 8% of the world's population, and the non-whites make up 90%. Yeah. I think back then it was reversed. I think whites made up the majority, and the non-whites made up the minority.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the whites would have been, they were the builders agriculturally, and, you know, building boats. And, you know, that what you're about to talk about is the technology. But what we're about to discuss kind of enabled us as a race to expand and to populate certain areas to grow, really, because we was able to set sail and discover these places, and we wasn't staying put. So I think it was obviously our kind of, the white man's burden, where we kind of taught the other races technology and agriculture, which essentially kept their birth rates high, because they would have died off more naturally. And that's kind of led to the boom, especially in Africa. I think without European intervention, Africa would nowhere near as be able to perpetuate its population as much as it is now, because the death rate per child would be a lot higher.
I think the Africans back then, they were still in the Sahara as well. I don't think there were Negro types. We got the black-headed type that were created. We're not quite sure who they are, and the Arabs. But I'm not sure that the black Africans would have actually even been in Sumer. I mean, there's an early reference to them. I forget which geographer it is. It might be Herodotus. And he was writing about the time of that Jesus was alive, or I think 50 or 60 years beforehand. And he's talking about Ethiopia, and he's talking about this race that lives in Ethiopia, and they're a white race. They're completely civilized. And then he says, and there's another group which are so far removed from human civilization as it's possible to get. And he describes them as having long nails and black woolly hair and running around naked and making a shrieking noise. And that's about the only reference there is. And later on, I think we get references to people in the Sudan, in the Egyptian civilization. But again, that's about 1,000 years after this, 2,000 years after this. And if you think there's just a million people in Sumer, I mean, there's probably more than that just living in London now, I would have thought. As you were saying there about the numbers, I mean, it would have been tempting, I think, for some of these peoples to think, well, we want to take over. How are we going to do that? Well, let's breed with these other races that are here, and we'll breed with them as much as we can. We'll make up the numbers and we'll use them in the army.
Well, I think a lot of that is to do with, it's often always linked to commerce, isn't it? If you take the nature of capitalism and, you know, and greed and these traits which kind of want to perpetuate more greed and wealth, you know, that's one of the, you know, the reasons to expand, and obviously breeding would up the numbers and expand quicker. So sometimes I think the mixing may have been, you know, pioneered by greed and just riches and things like that, not necessarily just to be kind of patriotic to your line and ancestry, but just through wealth and
breeding with your own people. Yeah, I mean that was encouraged. I mean, we were encouraged to have more than one wife for a start, and to have concubines. And you know, I think there would have been a temptation with some of the early white races, but there definitely was a temptation with the Canaanites and the Hamites to breed with the servant race that the Anunnaki created and the black-headed race. And we know that the Hittites were really proud of the fact that they were civilizing what they called the savage races. And there's one bit where they talk about civilizing them and marrying their princesses. And then they would go on to do the same, and they would effectively give their princesses to the Egyptians in a treaty. And the Hittites were well known for that. And that's why the Israelites were told, you know, never to accept or never to take Hittites as a wife. And that's what Esau Edom did. He took two Hittite princesses. And this was a common thing that the Hittites were known for. And I suspect, you know, Babylon, we know of Babylon as being a mix of peoples. So and that's because it's always been like that. So it would have been like that right the way back then, at the start of the Babylonian Empire. That was probably started through doing that, through breeding with these peoples that were around and creating masses of numbers so that you could keep power just by the number of people that you had, rather than keeping it through ingenuity, which you'd be more likely to have if you kept them all white. Well, let's have a look at the technology that was invented at this time. Some of the examples of technology that was invented in Sumer include the wheel, cuneiform script, arithmetic, and geometry. From 2600 BC onwards, the Sumerians wrote multiplication tables on clay tablets and dealt with geometrical exercises and division problems. They also had irrigation systems, boats, lunisolar calendars, bronze, leather, saws, chisels, hammers, braces, bits, nails, pins, rings, hoes, axes, knives, lance points, arrowheads, swords, glue, daggers, water skins, bags, harnesses, armor, quivers, war chariots, scabbards, boots, sandals, harpoons, and beer. And that's really not that different to what we had today up until the invention of the computer. And I guess you can say that steam, maybe that was new, but they had sailboats back then. They may not have had steam, but they had sailboats, they had canals, they had boats that were being towed along the canal by various different animals.
Yeah, I think the technology which helped populations to soar was obviously started from the Industrial Revolution, such as steam, like you say, but you know, like railway systems. I don't think they would have had them back then, right? Railway systems in order to transport goods and people, you know, movement of people was made that more rapid. I think think that, and you know, that was one of the major catalysts to booms in population.
It was all done by water back then. It was all done on these canals and on the rivers and at sea. Evidence of wheeled vehicles.
Transportation.
Yeah. Evidence of wheeled vehicles appeared in the mid-4th millennium BC, near simultaneously in Mesopotamia, the northern Caucasus, which was the Maykop culture, and central Europe, with the wheel initially taking the form of the potter's wheel. And if we remember, all they had before the flood was pottery. This new concept led to wheeled vehicles and mill wheels. And wheeled vehicles also means that there had to have been surfaced roads. So that's very similar to today. I mean, people forget that. They think, oh, you had to have a wheeled vehicle. But it also means that you had to have a road. They had to have proper roads, just like we have today, for walking along and for carriage.
And they were likely pedaled as well, weren't they? You'd have thought so. I mean, if they can make all that, it wouldn't be too hard to figure out how to make a wheel turn round with pedals and implement that.
Be able to turn it yourself. I don't know what's the oldest bicycle that they found, but they know what they had back then was chariots, and we'll get into how they had these how these chariots worked later on. The Sumerian's cuneiform script is the oldest writing which has been deciphered. The status of even older inscriptions, such as the Jahu symbols and Tartaria tablets, is controversial. The Sumerians were among the first astronomers, mapping the stars into sets of constellations, many of which survived in the zodiac and were also recognized by the ancient Greeks. They were also aware of the five planets that are easily visible to the naked eye, and they may have been a lot closer to the Earth at this time as well, which is a subject we hope to cover later in this series. So they had a proper understanding of astronomy and of the stars, and that was how that they managed to navigate, you know, because they managed to navigate all the way to Britain and all the way around the world, and they could do that by reading the stars. I mean, this is a very highly advanced civilization, and when we think from 3000 BC is when you had that Sumerian flood, and all of this is there within 500 years. They've suddenly got all of this from somewhere. It just appears. Yeah.
I mean, it would have been a different level of understanding, really, because you would have depend on the world around you, and the stars and the earth and whatnot. You have a different understanding, don't you? And things will help you to develop more understanding.
Well, I think there are certain things that can't develop. We have to have them, like. Language. You have to have somebody that can understand your language, and you have to have somebody that can speak the language. And how can that evolve from somewhere?
Yeah, I remember learning some things about the Sumerians years ago, not from too much of a historical perspective. I can't remember where or why, but I know that they were clued up on the solar systems and planets, and they often described one called Nibiru, which was a 10th planet. Do you know much about that?
I've heard of it. I've heard of it mentioned.
Yeah, because there were some carvings and etchings in stone, which literally depicts planets, you know, in the sky. And it's obvious that back then they knew what was up. It's not like it's quite a recent thing, I don't think. They were obviously aware that the Earth wasn't flat.
Well, there's also electric universe theory, which is basically that some of these rock carvings that we see, they're images of real things that you can see in plasma experiments, which show that the universe is electric. It's not a vacuum out there. There's an ether, basically, and the planets could have been much closer years ago, and that could have caused these electrical phenomena. So when you read about things happening like the flood, like the hailstones and all sorts of things that you read about in the Old Testament, it is possible that they could have happened with the planets being closer together and appearing in conjunction, and electric forces and having electromagnetism is what gravity is, and this ties in with other reports of these things happening, and it all stopped happening a few hundred years before Christ, and before then they call it the age of catastrophe. So the planets themselves would have been much closer, and they would have understood more about them, and they would have seen them as gods, and maybe that's, you know, the origin of these gods being associated with these different planets. You don't know what the effect of having the planets closer would have had on us as well, and what sort of dreams that the people would have had, because they placed a lot of importance on their dreams, a hell of a lot of importance on their dreams and interpreting them. And, you know, according to what they say in the Old Testament, that comes true. The same as they place so much importance on their words. And you know, if they blessed somebody, they would be blessed. If they cursed somebody, they would be cursed. The reason for that is because they led such upright lives. I mean, people out in India today, they do penances. And you see these people that will live up a pole for 7 years, or they will only eat vegetables, or they'll do some hardship. And the reason for doing that hardship is to try and build up spiritual power, so that they have the power to bless and to curse. And I think this was a much more common thing back then. There's a lot of things that we've forgotten about. Maybe our elites still know them, but they're not taught in public education.
I'm sure they do, yeah. I mean, end of the day, knowledge is power. Yeah. And so you've got to think, it's an equation, isn't it? If they have power, then they have more knowledge. And so then what do they know?
They're only going to let the stuff out.
That's for sure.
They're only going to let the stuff out that is going to keep us pacified, aren't they, really? They're not going to let anything out that can harm them.
I mean, imagine even what technology they've got today. I mean, you started to see these deep fakes come out all around the internet of different celebrities and stuff, and even apps where you can put your own face in. But, you know, that kind of technology probably existed 10, maybe 20 years ago. So you don't know what has been used. I saw a clip linked to me actually the other day. We're going off on a tangent, but Stanley Kubrick, he confessed to being the director behind filming the moon landing. You know, and he made a confession. Never knew about that. Don't know if it's true, but maybe some people listening might want to look into that.
Or was he just hoaxing everyone with his confession?
Maybe.
You just don't know, do you?
You don't know. You don't know. But it was interesting.
Well, getting back to history here, well, let's have a look at the musical instruments, the earliest musical instruments. The lyres of Ur, or the harps of Ur, are considered to be the world's second oldest surviving stringed instruments after the ones discovered in the Maykop culture. The Maykop culture was related to the Yamnaya culture, and they are another people who just suddenly appeared fully civilized shortly after the Sumerian flood of 3000 BC, replacing the people that were there before with a high culture whose origin is still quite unclear. Because I had a look at this Maykop culture and this Yamnaya culture, and the Maykop culture just literally suddenly appears, but with all this technology that they had. And the historians will say, well, they must have evolved from the people that were there before. There's nothing to say that they had to have evolved from them. They just suddenly arrived. I mean, why did the people that were there just suddenly think one day, oh, I know, let's invent all this technology? You know, they can't have done it. It had to have been brought there from outside. And I can't actually find a reference to this lyre that supposedly predates the ones that Woolley found at Ur. I mean, there's lots of references saying that the harps of Ur are the world's second oldest surviving stringed instruments, but you can't find the oldest one that is supposedly a part of this Maykop culture. I couldn't find that at all. But these ones that Woolley found at Ur, the archaeologists discovered the musical instruments when excavating the Royal Cemetery of Ur between 1922 and 1934, and they discovered pieces of three lyres and one harp there, and all are over 4,500 years old, being from the early dynastic III period of around 2,500 BC. The decorations on the lyres are fine examples of the court art of Mesopotamia of the period. One of the decorations is of Gilgamesh in the style which is replicated on the Sutton Hoo purse clasp found in Britain, and from in Britain 3,000 years later, basically. Leonard Woolley discovered the lyres among the bodies of 10 women in the Royal Cemetery at Ur, and one body was even said to be lying against the lyre with her skeletal hand placed where the strings would have been. Upon this discovery, Woolley was quick to pour a liquid plaster in to recover the delicate form of the wooden frame. The wood of the lyres was decayed, but since some were covered in non-perishable materials like gold and silver, they were able to be recovered. Strictly speaking, 3 lyres and 1 harp were discovered, but all are often called lyres. And I find this interesting as well. It shows that they had stringed instruments back then, and they were playing these stringed instruments, and they were very similar to the ones that we have today. And it was considered that important to them. They wanted this instrument in the Royal Cemetery with them.
And carry on, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, it's just so similar to what we have today. Okay, we've got amplified music today. We have electric guitars. But this is essentially the electric guitars of the day. And it was seen as very important. They had that. They had these musicians playing music in the same style that we have today. People are still play the harp today, don't they? The same instrument, thousands of years later.
Well, it's a very classical sound. So I think the fact that they chose those instruments, the fact that they gravitated to that type of sound that it would produce, must say something about their character at heart. You know, I mean, they could have settled for bongos and drum beating, couldn't they? Like some tribes do, you know, dancing around fires and whatnot. But they actually vouched for something very classically sounding. And maybe there's a link, in their choice of instruments to those things that we were talking about last week, in terms of, you know, like a leopard doesn't change his spots, the soul of a race is embedded in their DNA. You know, like the merchants, Jews were always called merchants back in the day, and they're merchants now today. So in the same way that, you know, our classical instruments have always been, you know, things like the harp and all the other classical instruments that kind of stemmed from that.
They all evolved from it. You know, when you think of the electric guitars we have today, they all evolved from the original stringed instrument, which was the harp. And I dare say wherever white people go, they will invent stringed instruments, because we like the sound of beautiful music and not the dancing around a fire with the bongos.
I think it has a certain resonance, doesn't it? And if you think that resonance of the sound as a waveform, it must resonate with us on a spiritual level, and maybe that's why we carry it with us throughout history.
Well, I think the chords are based on the golden section. You know, you have the golden section. Everything is made up of rectangles upon rectangles, and there's a curve. And when you look at the shape of shells, they all conform to this golden. Golden section, it's called, and the best paintings use this section, and artwork uses it. But also it's to do with music. The scale itself is based on that. So when you have music that is in tune and you play a chord, it's based on that golden section. It's just the musical version of it. So when they were playing the harp, you they would be playing sort of 3 strings together. And it will make a chord, and the reason why the chord sounds pleasing to the ear is because it has this ratio, this same ratio of the golden section.
Yeah, there's a definite pattern in nature for what defines beauty anyway, symmetry and triangles. I mean, I've studied art and design a lot, and when you study composition, for example, in a design piece, the best compositions and structures all have certain things in common, you know, like the rule of thirds, Fibonacci sequence, which is a mathematical sequence, and that was a completely different discovery to someone that discovered pi and the golden ratio in the visual form. So it's the universe has this programming code assigned to it where things that nature's, you know, born out of, and you get the harmonies in nature, and it just resonates.
The Fibonacci sequence is linked to the golden rectangle, isn't it? Phi?
Yeah.
it's the a mathematical same ratio, version,
basically, but in a different form. You have a visual form, and then you have the mathematical form. And I just think, you know, how could you not see creation behind the universe and think that this is just a randomness thrown together to form cohesion, you know, cohesiveness? It just doesn't make sense to me.
No, it's all ordered. And you don't get order naturally. You get chaos and decay and things falling apart. They don't naturally become more complex and perfectly in tune and perfectly in harmony.
No, exactly.
Moving on into the military, the almost constant wars among the Sumerian city-states lasting for 2,000 years helped to develop the military technology and techniques of Sumer to a high level. The first war recorded in any detail was between Lagash and Umma in 2450 BC and is recorded on a stele called the Stele of the Vultures. It shows the king of Lagash leading a Sumerian army consisting mostly of infantry, carrying spears, wearing copper helmets, and carrying rectangular shields. The spearmen are shown arranged in what resembles the phalanx formation, which requires training and discipline. And the Sumerian military used carts harnessed to onagers, which is a type of ass. These early chariots functioned less effectively in combat than did the later designs, and some have suggested that they served primarily as transports, although the crew carried battle axes and lances. The Sumerian chariot comprised a four- or two-wheeled device manned by a crew of two and harnessed to four onagers. The cart was composed of a woven basket, and the wheels had a solid three-piece design. The Sumerian cities were surrounded by defensive walls, and the tribes did engage in siege warfare between them, but their mud brick walls were able to deter some foes. So this was the origin of the chariot, and they fell out of use, but they were still being used in Britain. When Julius Caesar invaded Britain, we all had chariots here, and he had never seen chariot warfare. And yet we had these chariots, and the chariots that we had must go back to Troy and the Trojans, and the chariots that they had go back to Sumer. Mm-hmm. So it would have been effectively the same chariots as being described here that we had over here in Britain that we were using 1,000 years later, 1,500 years later.
Troy came before Rome, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
quite some time before.
There, but I thought Rome were quite big on their chariots. You know, you see them in the gladiator arenas, don't you? So they must have adopted it, or
it must have fallen out of use by the time that Julius Caesar was writing about it, or he must have noticed it and thought, well, this is an interesting idea, and brought it back to Rome.
Perhaps.
Now we come to debt and usury. Large institutions kept their accounts in barley and silver with a fixed rate of interest between them, and the obligations, loans, and prices in general were usually denominated in one of them. Many transactions involved debt, for example, goods that were consigned to merchants by the temple, and beer that was advanced by the ale women. Commercial credit and agricultural consumer loans were the main types of loans, and trade credit was usually extended by the temples in order to finance trade expeditions, and this was nominated in silver. The interest rate was set at 1/60th a month, which is 1 shekel per mina, sometime before 2000 BC, and it remained at that level for about 2,000 years. Rural loans commonly arose as a result of unpaid obligations that were due to an institution, such as a temple, and they were denominated in barley or other crops, with the interest rate typically being much higher than for commercial loans, and could amount to 1/3 or 1/2 of the loan principal. Periodically, rulers signed clean slate decrees that cancelled all the rural but not the commercial debt, and allowed bond servants to return to their homes. Customarily, rulers did this at the beginning of the first full year of their reign, but they could also be proclaimed at times of military conflict or crop failure. So what we have there is the debt jubilee that is described in the Bible, and that Alfred the Great still had at his time. And we see that they were really ripping the rural guys off here, charging them a third to a half of the loan principal, whereas the commercial institutions, it was just 1/60th a month that they had to pay.
Yeah, that's pretty harsh. I mean, it should be the other way around, really. I mean, what's your thoughts on usury in general? I think by today's standards, you know, the way we experience usury, you know, in terms of banks using us as civilians, you know, I can see it as wrong. But I think generally, as a nation, you shouldn't really be able to have such high interest, if any, really, on someone that's within a nation or, you know, the kindred to that nation, because they're kind of part of it. They're one body, aren't they? And so, you know, as a nation, you should be reap the same fruit and the fruitful rewards. But I think usury is something that could be applied to other nations, because then obviously they're not going to be part of the same reward system. And so, you know, if they want to indulge in your kind of riches, then I guess, you know, they weren't part of creating it, so therefore usury becomes applicable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, use it as a weapon of war. It should never be used among your own people. I mean, it's incredible that we've allowed that to happen. At least back here at this time, you were able to pay back loans in barley, so you could grow the crop, and you could pay it back like that. Whereas today, they just create the money when people request a loan. That money gets created, and then that loan has to be paid back. And the people that create the money to put into circulation, they don't actually put up anything of commensurate value. They just monetize that promise. And then when you pay that principal back, you still have to pay interest on top. But there's no interest in circulation. If you take out a loan, say, for £100, that £100 then gets created and goes into circulation, but you've got to pay back £110, you cannot pay back that extra £10 because there's only £100 in circulation. What that means is somebody else then also has to take a loan out. They take out £100, and then you've got £200 in circulation. So the first loan can be paid back, the £100 plus the £10, but then that second person hasn't got enough. So another loan has to be taken out. And that's why you end up with a huge, great debt mountain like the one that we have that is completely unserviceable, because you have to keep taking out loans rather than creating just enough that's actually needed for the project, and when it's paid, having it zeroed back. Money should just be a measure of value. It shouldn't actually have a value itself. It should just be a measure of value, so you can work out how much something is worth. You can say, well, that's worth so many pounds, and that's worth so many pounds, so now I need to give you so many pounds worth of my product here to pay for it, rather than actually being able to exchange it and use it as something that has a value in itself. It's like saying that a tape measure should be worth, you know, a lot of value depending on how far out you stretch the tape measure, because it doesn't actually represent anything. It represents nothing in actual fact. It's just paper. It doesn't actually have any value. And I think that's why they started off using gold for it and using things that did have value. And then through clever trickery, they ended up loaning out more than they actually had and saying, well, this is okay because it boosts the economy, because we're creating more things. And eventually it gets completely divorced from it, and there's no limits on the amount that these banks can produce. And yet the banks are not owned by the nation. I mean, if they were owned by the nation, at least then all that wealth they made would be funneled back into the people, but they're not. They're privately owned. And it was a similar thing that was going on here, because it was the temples that were doing this. It was the temples that were sending out these loans. And, you know, again, this is one of the pointers to whose ancestors it were that was doing this. Because when we look at the Europeans and we look at the historians that were writing about the Europeans, I think there's one on Germanicus, is a very famous one, and he says that the Europeans don't know usury. They don't use usury. It's alien to them. We never used usury. And when you look in the Old Testament, the Israelites, they never used usury. It was against the law for them to use it. And then when the Romans discovered the Europeans, they were amazed to see that we weren't using usury. So where did this usury idea, where did it come from? Well, it came from Sumer. It came from these people. I mean, they may have had the trappings of civilization, and some of that came from themselves, because when we read the earliest reports, we're told that the angels gave them metal technology. The angels gave them the ability to read and write. The angels gave them the ability to make music. So they did have all these gifts, but then what they were doing was selling out these gifts, and they became merchants, basically. And then the people that we now know as white, because don't forget, these Sumerians back then, they would have been pretty much the same as us. They were different to us, but we would probably describe them as white if we were to find their bodies today. And they ended up selling this stuff, and the Adamites, our ancestors, we ended up developing it and taking it further and being creative with it. And we have the traditions of being creative with it, and they have the traditions of being the merchants with it. So they will find something that we create, and they will promote it, and they will sell it, and they will make a profit from it. I mean, it's the same today. You look at musicians. No musicians know how to promote their music. They don't know how to make the money from it, and that's because it's not natural to us to do that. If you look in Henry Ford's book, and he talks about how music used to be completely free, and the idea that somebody could own music was completely alien. How could you own a song? You sing a song, or you write a song, and everybody sings the same songs. And then the merchants came in and said, "Well, no, we can sell this. We can commercialize it. We can make it into something that makes a profit." And then music became all about making a profit, and you had managers, and the managers were making all the money. And it's this merchant mentality. It's the two different ways of doing things. And this, we can really see this origin of it here in Sumer, I think, with this debt system that they had set up, and it was set up in the temple. And you got intelligent people in the temple that were doing this. I mean, it's not
and Sumer was heavily linked to Babylonia, right?
Yeah.
So no, I just wonder, because the Babylonian Talmud, I mean, that probably stretches way far back, doesn't it?
Well, not really. When you think about it, because the tribe of Judah was deported to Babylon in about 500 or 600 BC, and then they came back from Babylon to Judea, or a tiny portion of them did, about 10% of them did. And when they were there, Christ accused them of having the commandments of men, but they weren't actually written down. They were just the commandments of men. And then in the 4th or 5th century after Christ, they wrote them down, and that's when they became the Talmud. And that's when it became known as the Babylonian Talmud. So it wasn't until 4 or 5 centuries after Christ that the Babylonian Talmud actually took form. But these ideas, the Babylonian ideas, they would have been at Babylon, because Babylon was at Sumer. You had the Sumerian Empire, not really an empire, but you had Cain's system in Eridu. Then you had the flood. Then you had the Cushites had their system. Then you had Uruk that took over for 100 years. And then you had the Akkadians that came in, Sargon of Akkad. And then you had the Akkadian Empire, and it was the Akkadians that rebuilt Babylon and set up Babylon at one end of Sumer in the south. And in the north, they set up Asher, which was the capital of Assyria. And then you got Babylonia, which formed in the south, and Assyria that formed in the north. And all of that was Sumer. And that was the center of it all. So this debt system was in Babylon, and it was in Assyria as well, in Asher, and that was all Sumer. And that's where these ideas came from.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But the Babylonian Talmud didn't actually take form until after Christ. But the ideas go back.
The written form, but I was more implying about the ideas. They obviously took root and had influence, because the Babylonian Talmud is in the name, and we know that around the time of Babylon and all of these ideas would have stemmed from there, right?
Yeah, this is where they came from. And also don't forget the, you know, the Tower of Babel, the city that they built, and God confused the language because that was abhorrent to him. Whatever it was that they were doing there was abhorrent to him. Let's look at some more inventions here. They invented and developed arithmetic by using several different number systems, including a mixed radix system with an alternating base 10 and base 6, which became the standard number system used in Sumer and Babylonia. They may have invented military formations and did introduce the basic divisions between infantry, cavalry, and archers. They developed the first known codified legal and administrative systems, complete with courts, jails, and government records. The first true city-states arose in Sumer, roughly contemporaneously with similar entities in what are now Syria and Lebanon, with which they traded. Since the first evidence of civilization is in Sumer, it makes sense that the whites from there spread out from that center into Syria, Lebanon, and Anatolia, bringing their technology with them. Several centuries after the invention of cuneiform, the use of writing expanded beyond debt and payment certificates and inventory lists to be applied for the first time around 2600 BC to messages and mail delivery, history, legend, mathematics, astronomical records, and other pursuits. Conjointly with the spread of writing, the first formal schools were established, usually under the auspices of a city-state's primary temple. And they only say 2600 BC for this advent of writing because that's the earliest evidence that they have of it. We don't know for certain the exact date that people started using writing to record events, but we do have our early biblical eyewitnesses, and there are apocryphal texts that talk of writing being a gift from the angels or the gods. Now, one bit I find really interesting here, mail delivery. So they had postmen. They were able to write out these tablets, and then somebody would get on a horse and they would go and deliver it for you. And you could pass a message to somebody. And in order to do that, people had to be educated to be able to understand that writing. I mean, the system that they had is phenomenal. You think how many thousands of years ago this is, and it was so similar to what we have now. You think 200 years ago, you know, we didn't have schools for everybody. And yet they had formal schools here that were set up for people to go to. I dare say it would just be the most brightest people that actually went to them. It wouldn't have been everyone. It would have been people that showed that they had the capacity to learn. And then they would have taught them.
Yeah.
And that would have been from a caste as well, wouldn't it? Because they had a rigid caste system. So it would have been people from the top caste, and the top caste would have had the highest IQ, and they would have been the ones that learned how to do that. And then the ones with the lower IQ that may have been builder caste or farmers, labourers, they would have been taught how to ply their trades. And they would have taught it to their children. I think the caste system was so much better than the one that we have now, because the knowledge would have been passed down through the generations. You know, if you have a tradesman and he's being taught by his father, and his father was taught by his grandfather, that family is going to be really good at whatever trade it is that they do. They're going to be experts at it.
You do get glimpses of that now, you know, when things are passed on. So I can definitely see the benefits. Although I'm not sure IQ is strictly reserved for higher classes. I think sometimes it can crop up in a lower caste, just like a random genetic kind of anomaly.
Well, I'm not sure it would have done back then, because if you had castes, you know, they wouldn't have mixed with the other castes. If you had a caste, and if you had people that were really intelligent, you know, maybe they would have been bored with doing labouring work. I mean, I'm not trying to run them down, because you know, if you've got like really intelligent people that are working on books all the time, then you know their figure isn't going to be as good as the ones that are doing the labouring all the time, that sort of thing. And also it's hereditary, isn't it? And if you've got a caste, it's all about the genes and the bloodline.
I see your point. Yeah, it's a very good point. I guess it's hard to kind of get yourself in the mindset of understanding the caste system. But if it's caste, it's set, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, that's why it's called a caste system. But by today's standards, when you do get those anomalies of IQ or physical attributes, it is because the castes have been broken, and gene pools have separated, and then you're going to get these tangents, aren't you?
Yeah, that's the cause of it. That is the cause of it. The breaking down of the castes. I mean, the Anglo-Saxons had castes. The Danes had castes. The Israelites had castes. The Druids had a caste system, and you had to show who your ancestors were going back 10 generations. It was very important.
Isn't the royal family technically a caste system?
Yeah, that's the last traces of it, is the royal family. And look at what Prince Harry did. He's got no understanding whatsoever of where he came from or who he is. Or what his traditions are. It's really sad.
His dad is quite a little bit dubious anyway, isn't he? He looks a lot like that guy. What's his name?
James Hewitt, is it, or something? Or am I?
Yeah, James Hewitt. If you look at them, they're identical. And I don't know if he's royalty, but he doesn't look so much like Charles. So I wonder if they know deep down, and he's kind of doing like an Esau and just kind of going off on one. I'm gonna leave the cast.
Good analogy there, I think. Good analogy. Yeah. Well, let's have a look at the trade and exploration to finish up with. Discoveries of obsidian originating from faraway locations in Anatolia and lapis lazuli from Badakhshan in northeastern Afghanistan, beads from Dilmun, which is modern Bahrain, and several seals inscribed with the Indus Valley script suggest a remarkably wide-ranging network of ancient trade centered on the Persian Gulf. For example, imports to Ur came from many parts of the world. In particular, the metals of all types had to be imported. Interestingly, while the Wikipedia page on this mentions gold, silver, lapis lazuli, and chlorite, it makes no mention of the most important metal import of all, which was required for making the bronze for the Bronze Age, and that metal is tin. The largest tin mines in Europe were those in Britain, and they were the only ones we knew of up until fairly recently, when some much smaller ones were discovered in the Balkans. Sumer and the ancient world had to have been getting their tin from Britain, because it would have been known as a precious metal otherwise. And that's covered up, that's hidden. Because they don't want you to know that Sumer was connected with Europe at the time. They want you to think that they were just cavemen in Europe, and they evolved from cavemen. And, this shows us that they were colonizers and explorers that went out looking for the resources that they didn't have in Sumer. And they had to go outside of Sumer to get these resources to bring them back. And tin was absolutely essential for the Bronze Age.
Yeah.
The Epic of Gilgamesh refers to trade with far-off lands for goods that were scarce in Mesopotamia, such as wood. In particular, the cedar from Lebanon was prized, which we also read about in the Bible, and which confirms for us that Phoenicia and Lebanon were fertile forest lands at this time. The finding of resin in the tomb of Queen Puabi at Ur indicates that it was traded from as far away as Mozambique, which is hardly that far away when we know that they had regular trade routes to Britain for this tin. I mean, that amazes me that we had these connections back then. We were truly global back then. White people were global, that they had connections from all the way from Sumer all the way to Britain, and they had a mail system. They would have been able to communicate between the two. And we've got records of the Phoenicians sailing around Britain, or I think it was a Greek guy that was sailing around Britain, and he said he could see the Phoenician ships that were going out to St. Michael's Mount and collecting the tin from the coracles to take back to the Near East. These Phoenicians were, and there's also records of the Phoenicians guarding this route and preventing other people from getting out through the Pillars of Hercules, because they didn't want them to see where they were getting their tin from. Because they could only get it from Britain. Britain was really important from very early times for the birth of civilization.
I mean, how do you make tin? Isn't it copper and bronze?
No, it's tin comes out of the ground.
Yeah, but isn't it a fusion of other metals?
No. To make bronze, you have to use tin.
Oh, okay. I know they were connected, but
Yeah, to make bronze, you have to have tin.
Right.
I'm not sure. Is tin and lead, or tin and copper?
I think it's tin and copper. I learned that in Valheim.
Tin and copper, and they find lead nearby alongside the tin, I think.
Yeah, but it's quite interesting. How long do you know of the industry, being around for in Britain, being the centre of tin? Because I heard that Christ actually took a trip to the British Isles during his time. So I just wonder if it was going on for like a good, century, a few centuries.
Yeah, well, that's because the legend was that Joseph of Arimathea was a nobilis decurio. He was responsible for collecting the tin from Britain.
Right.
He was involved in the tin trade. That's what the legends are. But I don't know when the first record of it is. I mean, you've got this Greek record, which is about 600 BC, I think. But then you've got records of the Phoenicians going out to the Cassiterides, I think they call it. The Phoenicians were going out to collect tin from somewhere, and nobody knew where it was, and they fiercely guarded where it was that they were getting this tin from. And though there are smaller tin mines that they found just in the last 100 years in the Balkans, there's no way that they could have provided enough tin for the Bronze Age in the Fertile Crescent. And if Britain hadn't been doing it, it would have been a precious metal. It would have been more precious than gold, because they had loads of gold that they could get hold of.
Mm.
And yet it wasn't. There was enough of it for them to use it to make bronze with. So the fact they had enough tin shows that they had to be connected to Britain at that time, because Britain was the only place that could have provided enough tin for them to use it.
What was the tin being used for? Do you know? Pottery?
Bronze. Everything that you can make things out of bronze with.
Yeah.
Helmets. But it's not. Shields.
Yeah, so it's all linked to armour, isn't it? Warfare, yeah. Armour, metals.
Warfare, mainly.
Yeah.
And weaponry. Yeah, yeah. Weaponry, I would have thought. And then you get the Iron Age after that. The tin's always been important. And I'm trying to think how far afield British tin has been traced back to. I'm sure there's some connection to it being out in India at a very, very early point as well. British tin making it as far as India. But if you think the Bronze Age took out all the classical world, and there's very few places where we actually have tin mines. That's another thing that they try to play down, and that they don't want people to learn about. But I think we should probably leave it there, and we'll have a look at the Indus Valley civilization next week, I think. Thank you very much for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.